when we find that we need God's guidance for something, the best way to find that is to stick to what you know God has given you to do.
Shortly after her husband, Jim Elliott, and four other missionaries were speared to death trying to reach out to a tribal group in Ecuador, Elizabeth Elliott was able to live and work with the same tribe for 2 years. It's a remarkable story of forgiveness, love, and the power of the gospel to change lives. Through her visits here on Gateway to Joy, Elizabeth continues to reach out with the timeless message of hope and healing. Here's your friend, Elizabeth Elliott.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend Elizabeth Elliott, talking with you this time about a divine appointment. I told you in my last talk about what seemed a rather ridiculous prayer that I prayed right after my husband Jim Elliott was killed by a tribe of Indians in South America called Aucas. This was back in 1956. And because he and the other four men had attempted to take the gospel to these people and had failed in that attempt, I prayed this seemingly absurd prayer. I said, "Lord, if there's anything you want me to do about those Aucas, I'm available." I really didn't expect God to answer a prayer like that. And when we find that we need God's guidance for something, the best way to find that is to stick to what you know God has given you to do. I think if you stick to the given in order, then you will be able to recognize new orders when they come. Sometimes we get distracted from the job which God has clearly given us to do because we're so concerned about some decision that has to be made later. Well, I went back to my station, I stuck to business there, and all sorts of strange things happened. During the next 2 years, I got piles and piles of mail from people who had read the stories in Life magazine and in the Reader's Digest, and also the book that I had written called Through Gates of Splendor, giving me all kinds of suggestions about what really ought to be done next about those Alca Indians. I had letters from people telling me the mistakes that the five men had made, why they got killed. I had anthropologists and psychologists giving me their theories and their recommendations and their prescriptions. I had people who had read the encyclopedia to find out what the savage mind is like. One lady wrote to me and she said, "Please write out the Ten Commandments on a piece of paper and drop them to the Indians from the airplane." She didn't tell me what language they should be written in or how these people were going to read them. Another dear soul sent me $60 to buy Bibles for the Aucas, not realizing, of course, that the Aucas not only didn't have any Bibles, the Aucas didn't even have a written language, nor had they ever heard of such a thing as writing. So there were methods, means, materials, and specific directions galore. But would there ever be such a time? Would such a time ever come when God would actually want me to go in there? I had to keep my mind on today's work. In May of 1957, Johnny Keenan, one of the pilots that was carrying on the work that Nate Saint had begun with Missionary Aviation Fellowship in Ecuador, invited me to fly with him as he was making gift drops over Alca territory. This was certainly the thrill of a lifetime. These were the people who had killed my husband, and yet I didn't hate them, I loved them, and I certainly hoped that somebody someday would be able to take the gospel to them. And here was just one little thing that I could do which might contribute something toward that end. And so we flew together in the little tiny plane. Johnny had taken the door off, and I was strapped in very securely next to that door, but I could look straight down quite a few hundred feet to the ground as he dropped the parachute with gifts for these people. And there I could actually see the face of a young man who had had what appeared to be a friendly contact with the five men just before they were killed. Not knowing his real name, the five missionaries had nicknamed him George. There was George. We were flying low enough so that I could actually see his face. He grabbed the package, tore it open, found a hamburger with a bun. He wolfed it down. Well, I can hardly describe the feelings that I had then, but I had been reading the 60th Psalm. O God, Thou hast cast us off and broken us. Thou hast been angry and rebuked us cruelly. Thou hast made the land quake and torn it open. It gives way and crumbles into pieces. Thou hast made Thy people drunk with a bitter draught. Thou hast given us wine that makes us stagger. That first section of the psalm certainly described some of my feelings when my husband was taken away. I felt rebuked, crumbled. I felt that God had given me a bitter drink. And yet, the psalmist goes on, and at the end of the psalm, this is what he says, "Who can bring me to the fortified city? Who can guide me to Edom? Since Thou, O God, hast abandoned us and goest not forth with our armies. Grant us help against the enemy, for deliverance by man is a vain hope. With God's help we shall do valiantly, and God Himself will tread our enemies underfoot." I sort of took those verses as not exactly a promise, but maybe a hint that God was going to take me to that fortified city, that forbidden savage territory of the Aucas into which no one had ever gone and come back out alive. My husband and the other men that were killed were just among a number of people who had attempted to reach those people, and none had ever been heard from again. So one day on the radio, I received an invitation from a missionary named Dr. Tidmarsh asking if I would come to his station, which happened to be the closest one to Alca territory. And he said, "I'm going out for a few days to Quito to do some shopping. My wife, Gwen, really doesn't relish staying alone in the jungle. Would you be willing to come and spend a weekend or a few days with her?" Well, I think of the fact that I'm not here to do my own will, but to do God's will. To be quite honest, I didn't really want to go to the Tidmarsh's station. I had plenty to do on my own. I had a class of girls that I didn't like to suspend. I was teaching them to read, but I said, "Well, I'll pray about it," and I did pray about it, and it seemed that the Lord was telling me to go. So I called them on the radio the next day. We had a shortwave contact with all of the mission stations in the jungle, and I eventually flew over to the station called Arahuno. There was another couple that was now staying in Shandia, so they were able to man that station while I was gone. I had only been in Arahuno for a couple of days with my daughter Valerie and Gwen Tidmarsh when suddenly one morning, quite to our surprise, two Quechua men from a long way away were at the door. They said, "There are two Alca women at our house. Do you want to see them?" I had about 5 minutes to make up my mind. I had given word to these people, the Quechuas who lived nearest to Alca territory, that if ever any Alcas were seen, that they should get word to me. Little could they imagine that they were actually going to find me in person at the station called Arahuno. They were just coming there to send word by radio to me. "Yes," I said, "I want to see them." So very quickly, having practically no time to really think, I threw a notebook and pencils and a snake bite kit and some soap and a change of clothes and a blanket and some insect repellent into an Indian carrying net and set off with these two Quechua Indians. Gwen had offered to take care of my daughter Valerie, so she stayed behind. We hadn't gone more than about 1 mile when the two Indians turned around and looked at this foreign senora coming along the trail behind them, and they said, "Do you think you can make it?" Well, I had been on many trails many times before, but I guess they'd never seen a foreigner make it on one of these trails. The trails were rather rugged, may I say. They were narrow, maybe 1 foot wide. They often had rocks, mud. They crossed rivers. And as we went along the trail, every once in a while, the two Quechuas, who were quite edgy, and one of them had a gun over his shoulder, he said, "You know, the Alcas walk these trails, too. You see that flattened grass over there, senora? That means that some Alcas were lying here just last night. You see that hollow place there? That's where an Alca made a camp." And I sort of made fun of what they said. I said, "Alcas, I think that flattened grass is just because of a wild pig." And one of them said, "Wild pig. This woman doesn't know anything." As I traveled along the trail, I was thinking about Jim, because I was nearing the territory in which he had been killed. For some reason, the old Negro spiritual came to mind, "I won't have to cross Jordan alone." I thought I might be walking into the same kind of a situation that Jim walked into. I had no way of knowing. Finally, after 6 hours on that trail, we arrived at a little clearing on the Oglan River, where these two Indian men lived. There, before my eyes, were two real, live Alka women. They were dressed by this time. The Quechua women had put clothes on them during the day, but I could see the large holes in their earlobes, which told me that they were not Quechuas. I couldn't speak a word to them. They couldn't speak a word to me that I understood, but they didn't know that I didn't understand. They talked away. They looked at my matches. They'd never seen anything like that. I showed them my flashlight, my watch. One of the Indians showed them a cigarette and tried to get them to smoke it. We got them to taste salt. These were all brand new experiences. We sang, and they sang their very strange song of two notes. The Quechuas were afraid when they heard them sing. They said, "They're casting a spell." They kept their guns and lances ready in case the Alcas should come out and kill us. They said, "Perhaps they're going to do the same thing to us that they did to your husband and the rest of the men." During the night, suddenly the dogs barked. The men jumped to their feet with guns and lances ready. "You're a decoy, senora. They've just brought you down here in order to kill us all." But that night I found peace in my soul. I found that one of the Alka women, the next morning, she was shaking with chills and fever. I happened to have some malaria pills with me. I gave her one of the pills. To my amazement, without any hesitation, she swallowed it with some water. How did she know I wasn't trying to kill her? She trusted me. Perhaps that was part of God's answer to prayer. The men went out to work the next morning for a couple of hours, but everybody was restless and apprehensive. This was God's divine appointment for me.
Anything, if offered to God, can and will become your gateway to joy. Elizabeth Elliott has been sharing timeless truth with ladies for many years. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.